From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
You know, there's a mainstream in American politics, and you sit right on the far left bank. As a matter of fact, your record is such that Ted Kennedy, your colleague, is the conservative senator from Massachusetts.
6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, where is Osama bin Laden? He said, I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned. We need a president who stays deadly focused on the real war on terror.
John Kerry and George W. Bush face off in their last debate ahead of November's election. We'll get reaction from legendary historian Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States.
Imagine, here's a political system in which half the country has already indicated that it is opposed to the war, 50% of the country opposed to the war, and 100% of the candidates in favor of the war. Now, that is not a free election.
We'll speak with labor activist Brenda Stokely, look at the health care plans of the two candidates, and talk to CNN correspondent Maria Nejosa about this immigrant nation.
It's an issue the candidates don't want to talk about, but across the country, no matter what side you're on, people are talking about it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush and Senator John Kerry battled over health care, jobs, taxes, and other domestic issues in the third and final presidential debate of the campaign last night. The two candidates also outlined differences on immigration, abortion, gay marriage, the minimum wage, and their different faiths. Both candidates also took advantage of several chances to weave the Iraq War into the debate, which was held in the key swing state of Arizona. During one exchange, Kerry quoted Bush as saying he doesn't think much about Osama bin Laden and is not all that concerned about him. The president replied, quote, I just don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations, he said. But at a news conference on March 13th, excuse me, 2002, just as the buildup for the Iraq War was getting underway, Bush did say about bin Laden. Bush, Ron, you'll have to take it away.
During one exchange, Kerry
quoted Bush as saying he does not think much about Osama bin Laden, is not at all concerned about him. The president replied, quote, I just don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's not one of those, it's kind of one of those exaggerations. But at a press conference on March 13, 2002, just as the buildup for the Iraq War was getting underway, Bush did say about bin Laden, quote, I truly am not that concerned about him. I know he is on the run. He described bin Laden as, quote, marginalized and said, quote, I just don't spend that much time on him. In Iraq, 8 civilians are thought to have been killed and 4 wounded in an attack on Baghdad's heavily fortified Green Zone. A total of 6 U.S. soldiers have died during a 24-hour period on Tuesday and Wednesday. 3 soldiers were killed in Sadr City by a roadside bomb in Mosul. A suicide bomber attacked a U.S. convoy, killing 2 more soldiers, and a 6 soldier died in a roadside bombing in West Baghdad. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is reporting that the U.S. may be helping to better arm the Iraqi resistance by offering cash to supporters of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr if they turn in their weapons. An analyst at Jane's Defense Weekly told AP many fighters are turning in broken or old guns for cash and then spending the money on new weapons. He said, quote, the Mahdi Army's disarmament is something of a mirage. Yesterday in Baghdad, the unelected Prime Minister Ayed Alawi threatened to attack Fallujah if the Iraqi resistance does not turn over suspected al-Qaeda Zarqawi. Back at home in Virginia, a 37-year-old soldier who recently returned from Iraq hanged himself in jail on Saturday, less than a month after he returned. Brian McKeon had been arrested for assaulting his wife. In the month since he returned from Iraq, police said they had responded to about 6 complaints against McKeon filed by his wife and neighbors. In election news, a former Republican operative in Nevada has failed in an attempt to purge 17,000 Democrats from the state's voting rolls. Nevada's former Republican chair, Dan Burdish, claimed that the Democrats were inactive voters, but county officials rejected the request. Meanwhile, in Oregon, the Secretary of State and Attorney General have announced plans to investigate allegations that a Republican-funded company called Voters Outreach of America threw out voter registration forms filed by Democrats. Similar complaints have surfaced about the same company in Nevada. Former employees of the company have said they personally saw supervisors toss out voter registration forms filed by Democrats. The move could leave hundreds and possibly thousands of Democrats in Oregon and Nevada unable to vote, even though they have registered. In other campaign news, a state court in Pennsylvania knocked Ralph Nader off the state's presidential ballot, charging that his petitions contained thousands of fraudulent signatures. The judge said Nader fell 6,000 signatures short of the required 25,000 to appear on the ballot. Attorneys representing detainees at Guantanamo argued in court yesterday that none of the detainees has been given a chance to appear in a courtroom despite the Supreme Court's ruling 3 months ago that declared the jailed men have the right to challenge their imprisonments in U.S. courts. The Washington Post reports that defense attorneys yesterday told the U.S. District Judge that only a handful of detainees have even spoken to their lawyers so far. And lawyers said the government has also broken a court ordered September 30th court order to justify why they are detaining each man. And finally, this item. Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly is being charged with sexual harassment in a $60 million lawsuit. Andrea Macris, an associate producer of the O'Reilly Factor, accused the conservative talk show host of making, quote, disgusting phone calls to her and threatening to ruin her career if she complained. In the suit, Macris also claims O'Reilly pestered her for three-way sex with another woman and bragged about his prowess in bed. O'Reilly fired back with a lawsuit of his own, contending he's the target of a politically motivated extortion plot to, quote, punish him and Fox News. And that's all the headlines. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and Juan Gonzalez here, too. Juan, thanks for bailing me out there.
That's okay, Amy.
I think it's one too many speeches. I'm not sure. But you have a very interesting piece today in the New York Daily News.
Yes, well, I have a column dealing with the situation in Florida. 3 weeks away from the election, Florida seems headed for another huge fiasco with massive voter problems. Palm Beach County apparently did try to test this week of their new Touchstone electronic machines, and there was a complete crash as they were about to do the test, a computer crash in the election headquarters, and they're going to be trying again on Friday. But 3 weeks beforehand, they don't even have their new touchtone screen system operational, even though there are questions it because it doesn't have paper ballots. In addition, there was a lawsuit filed by a number of Floridians, African Americans, and Hispanics, a voting rights lawsuit filed against the state of Florida this week because apparently thousands of people who registered to vote their applications were held up or denied for minor errors on the forms. For instance, in Miami-Dade County alone, 3,500 applications were rejected because the people failed to check a box asking if they were mentally incapacitated, if they had been judged mentally incapacitated or not. 1,200 people were denied applications, voter registration cards, because they failed to check the box that says, are you a U.S. citizen? Even though at the bottom of the form, they've signed an affidavit that says, I am a U.S. citizen. And about 3,000 were denied because they failed to check the box asking if you've ever been a convicted felon. Given the fact that the state has to check both of those things independently, whether you're mentally incapacitated or a convicted felon, regardless of what you put on your form, the civil rights lawyers are claiming this is an attempt to deny lots of people throughout Florida the chance to vote.
Well, another story, too, we wanted to follow up on yesterday's big piece, the expose that Naomi Klein did for The Nation magazine. Well, less than a day after she reported on a secret multi-billion-dollar deal involving former Secretary of State James Baker and Madeleine Albright negotiating to buy out Iraq's debt to Kuwait, the deal now appears to be dead. In a major expose, the magazine reported on confidential documents showing that the Carlyle Group, of which Baker is a partner, was part of a consortium along with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Under the deal, the consortium would use its, quote, personal connections to persuade world leaders that Iraq must maximize its debt payments to Kuwait. The consortium's stated goal directly contradicts the U.S. foreign policy aim of Baker's mission. He, of course, is President Bush's special envoy dealing with Iraq's debt. The Nation columnist Naomi Klein reported that on January 21, 2004, Baker flew to Kuwait to meet with top government officials, including the foreign minister, ostensibly to discuss whether Kuwait would forgive the $57 billion in sovereign debt and war reparations owed by Iraq. On the very same day, the debt restructuring proposal, which asks the government of Kuwait to pay a $1 billion investment to Carlyle, was hand-delivered to Kuwait's foreign minister. Since the story broke yesterday, Carlyle's now trying to completely disown any involvement in the deal. Initially, Carlyle had confirmed to The Nation that it was aware of the proposal and that they stood to make $1 billion. But last night, they changed their tune. In a statement to Naomi Klein, Carlyle Vice President Chris Ullman said, quote, even if there is money to invest, Carlyle will not invest it. We learned today that we did not even join the consortium, he wrote. When I spoke to you yesterday, I did not know that. We had not actually joined the consortium. We're in discussions with them to join, but we declined to sign the memorandum for several reasons, including the fact that Secretary Baker had been named to the envoy job. Carlyle also wrote a letter to the consortium, the Kuwaiti government, and the Albright Group, saying it had nothing to do with the deal. Carlyle's general counsel wrote, quote, we expect the consortium to cease using Carlyle's name and to cease stating or implying that Carlyle has any connection, involvement, or financial interest in its current or prospective work. It does look like Naomi Klein's expose in The Nation had quite an effect, a $2 billion effect. Well, we're going to move on now to the elections and to the final debate that was held last night in Tempe, Arizona, at Arizona State. Juan?
Yes, well, President Bush and Senator John Kerry battled over health care, jobs, taxes, immigration, and many other domestic issues in their third and final debate last night. It was their last chance for the two major party candidates who are locked in a tight race to address a mass audience before the November 2nd election in 3 weeks.
The debate was held in the key swing state of Arizona at Arizona State University. Along with health care, jobs, and taxes, Kerry and Bush outlined differences on other domestic issues, including immigration, abortion, gay marriage, the minimum wage, as well as addressing their different faiths.
While the 90-minute face-off was focused on domestic issues, both candidates took advantage of several chances to weave the Iraq war into the discussion. This is an excerpt of last night's debate with moderator Bob Schieffer of CBS News opening it.
By a coin toss, the first question goes to Senator Kerry. Senator, I want to set the stage for this discussion by asking the question that I think hangs over all of our politics today and is probably on the minds of many people watching this debate tonight, and that is, will our children and grandchildren ever live in a world as safe and secure as the world in which we grew up?
Well, first of all, Bob, thank you for moderating tonight. Thank you, Arizona State, for welcoming us. And thank you to the Presidential Commission for undertaking this enormous task. We're proud to be here. Mr. President, I'm glad to be here with you again to share similarities and differences with the American people. Will we ever be safe and secure again? Yes, we absolutely must be. That's the goal. Now, how do we achieve it is the most critical component of it. I believe that this president, regrettably, rushed us into a war, made decisions about foreign policy, pushed alliances away, and as a result, America is now bearing this extraordinary burden where we are not as safe as we ought to be. The measurement is not, are we safer? The measurement is, are we as safe as we ought to be? And there are a host of options that this president had available to him, like making sure that at all our ports in America, containers are inspected, only 95% of them 95% come in today uninspected. That's not good enough. People who fly on airplanes today, the cargo hold is not x-rayed, but the baggage is. That's not good enough. Firehouses don't have enough firefighters in them. Police officers are being cut from the streets of America because the president decided to cut the COPS program. So we can do a better job of homeland security. I can do a better job of waging a smarter, more effective war on terror and guarantee that we go after the terrorists. I will hunt them down and we'll kill them, we'll capture them, we'll do whatever necessary to be safe. But I pledge this to you, America. I will do it in the way that Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan and John Kennedy and others did, where we build the strongest alliances, where the world joins together, where we have the best intelligence, and where we are able ultimately to be more safe and secure.
Mr. President, you have 90 seconds.
Bob, thank you very much. I want to thank Arizona State as well. Yes, we can be safe and secure if we stay on the offense against the terrorists and if we spread freedom and liberty around the world. I have got a comprehensive strategy to not only chase down al-Qaeda wherever it exists, and we're making progress. Three-quarters of al-Qaeda leaders have been brought to justice, but to make sure that countries who harbor terrorists are held to account. And as a result of securing ourselves and ridding the Taliban out of Afghanistan, the Afghan people had elections this weekend. And the first voter was a 19-year-old woman. Think about that. Freedom is on the march. We held to account a terrorist regime in Saddam Hussein. In other words, in order to make sure we're secure, there must be a comprehensive plan. My opponent just this weekend talked about how terrorism can be reduced to a nuisance, comparing it to prostitution and illegal gambling. I think that attitude and that point of view is dangerous. I don't think you can secure America for the long run if you don't have a comprehensive view as to how to defeat these people. At home, we'll do everything we can to protect the homeland. I signed the Homeland Security Bill to better align our assets and resources. My opponent voted against it. We're doing everything we can to protect our borders and ports. But absolutely, we can be secure in the long run. It just takes good, strong leadership.
Anything to add, Senator Kerry?
Yes. When the president had an opportunity to capture or kill Osama bin Laden, he took his focus off of him, outsourced the job to Afghan warlords, and Osama bin Laden escaped. 6 months after he said Osama bin Laden must be caught dead or alive, this president was asked, where is Osama bin Laden? He said, I don't know. I don't really think about him very much. I'm not that concerned. We need a president who stays deadly focused on the real war on terror.
Mr. President.
Gosh, I don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. That's kind of one of those exaggerations. Of course we're worried about Osama bin Laden. We're on the hunt after Osama bin Laden. We're using every asset at our disposal to get Osama bin Laden. My opponent said this war is a matter of intelligence and law enforcement. No, this is a war is a matter of using every asset at our disposal to keep the American people protected.
An excerpt of last night's debate. In that last exchange between the two candidates, Kerry quotes Bush as saying he doesn't think much of about Osama bin Laden and is not all that concerned about him. The president replies, quote, I just don't think I ever said I'm not worried about Osama bin Laden. It's kind of one of those exaggerations.
But at a press conference on March 13, 2002, just as the buildup for the Iraq war was getting underway, Bush did say about bin Laden, quote, I truly am not that concerned about him. I know he is on the run. He described bin Laden as, quote, marginalized and said, quote, I just don't spend that much time on him.
Well, today we'll spend the rest of the hour talking about this third and final presidential debate. We'll be joined by historian Howard Zinn, labor activist Brenda Stokely. We'll speak about health care and talk with immigration with Maria Hinojosa of CNN and Latino USA. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! That was Lead Belly. DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. By the way, just talking not only about the candidates, but the anchor of last night's debate, CBS News anchor Bob Schieffer. In January 2003, Howard Kurtz of The Washington Post penned a profile of Schieffer, who happens to hail from Bush's own Texas. Kurtz included this bit of family history, quote, during the 90s, Bob Schieffer also struck up a friendship with George W. Bush when his brother Tom, now the U.S. ambassador to Australia, became partners with the future president and the Texas Rangers. Bob and W. went to ball games together, played golf, attended spring training. He's a great guy. That doesn't mean I agree with him, says Schieffer, adding that the situation became a little awkward when Bush ran for the White House, but that he's never gotten favorable treatment. Well, right now, we're going to turn to historian Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States, now a new book with Anthony Aronoff called Voices of People's History of the United States. He joins us in our Firehouse studio here at Democracy Now! Welcome, Howard Zinn.
Thank you, Amy and Juan.
It's great to have you with us. If you could just comment overall about this presidential contest right now. We are just weeks away from the election.
You know, the contest, unfortunately, you know, is not giving us any kind of fundamental reappraisal of American policy, foreign and domestic. I mean, by a fundamental reappraisal, I mean we are dealing with a serious issue of the war in Iraq, and we're dealing with the serious issues of health and education and what to do with the wealth of the United States to help people. And neither candidate is addressing the fundamentals. By that, I mean, I heard, you know, them on the clip that you showed and talk about Osama bin Laden in exchange, you know, accusations about, you know, and, you know, and, you know, Bush denying, of course, as he denies everything, you know, about what he said, and Kerry saying, no, you said that. And it's not important, really, about Osama bin Laden. They're always trying to focus our attention on something that's not fundamental. What's fundamental is not one particular man. What's fundamental is not even al-Qaeda. What's fundamental, really, is American policy in the world. Because if there is a root of terrorism, and that's the problem, getting at the root of terrorism is not any one man, not any group of people in this country or that country. There are too many countries where there's anger against the United States and where that anger against the United States can turn into fanaticism and into terrorism. And the reason is all this anger against the United States is that America has its hands, its armies, its military bases in too many countries in the world. We are intervening too violently in too many places. We are initiating wars as we have in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have military bases in over 100 countries. We've been supporting the occupation of the Palestinian lands. In other words, Bush and Sharon have been acting in the same superficial way and absolutely unproductive way in dealing with violence. And I think that neither candidate is really dealing with the question of what is the role of America in the world. Are we continuing to be a military superpower, sending our troops everywhere whenever we feel like, or are we going to become a peaceful nation and use our immense resources to help people in this country and do something about universal health care, do something about education, and at the same time have resources available so that we can deal with the other problems in the world? There are problems even more serious than Iraq, like the enormous disaster in the Sudan and or the AIDS in Africa. If you have a $400 billion military budget, if you are sending troops and keeping troops in other countries in the world, you don't have any resources left to deal with the really serious human disasters that are taking place there and here.
Howard, you know, as a news junkie, I've watched every minute of all four of these debates, and it still astounds me, although I think Bob Schieffer clearly did the best job of any of the questioners, at least asking some tough questions of the candidates, all of the things that were really not dealt with. I mean, the environment, the policies of these the Bush administration and Kerry's policy toward the environment, not discussed at all. Energy policy and the United States' continued search for maintaining control of the world's oil supply to justify our consumption. The issue of civil liberties, attacks on civil liberties by this government, and the continued pursuit of Arab Americans on false charges, the Patriot Act. None of this was discussed, and I just am astounded at these issues that many Americans, and including I think Tavis Smiley said the. There was one question about affirmative action in African Americans, but with the continued cultural and racial changes in American society, very little attention to the continuing problems of racism and discrimination, not just with African Americans, but Latinos and Arab Americans as well. It's I blame it more on the journalists than I do on the candidates. The candidates will only respond to questions that they're asked, and the journalists haven't chosen to ask any of these questions.
Well, you as a journalist, you know, a good position to criticize the limitations of other journalists, just as I, as a historian, tend to look carefully at the kind of history that is taught in our schools and the limitations of that history. But what you're saying, Juan, about what the candidates are not discussing, what they're not bringing up, I think relates to the fact that if both candidates want to continue the war in Iraq, as they seem to do, although Kerry, you know, gives little indications that, you know, maybe he will move away from this. This is enough reason for me for voting for Kerry. He gives little hints, you know, like, you know, we shouldn't have rushed into war, implying that maybe we should have gone more slowly into war. No. But the little... despite these little hints that Kerry gives that maybe he is more inclined to stop this war. Certainly everybody is more inclined to stop this war than Bush. You know, both candidates, by saying they will continue and the war and win the war, are saying that we will continue to have a $400 billion military budget. We will continue to be spending huge sums of money on the war. So long as they do that, even though Kerry has a better health plan and a better education plan, so long as we are spending all that money for war, we are not going to be able to give people universal health care. We are not going to be able to take care of the other problems with the environment that you were talking about, Juan. And that is the whole issue of the relationship between the war and domestic policy has been missing from the campaign.
There are some anti-war candidates, people like David Cobb, Green Party, Ralph Nader. Now, there was that controversial letter that you signed along with Noam Chomsky and others calling for people to vote for Kerry in the swing states. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I didn't think I'd signed a contract. Controversial letter, Amy. I try not to be controversial, but I guess there are people, very strong supporters of Nader and Cobb, who were annoyed because a number of us said, people who admire Nader, admire the Green Party, said people should vote for Kerry in the swing states. And I think the reason is this, and I don't know if I'm speaking for all the other signers of the petition, but probably I would guess that this is their thinking. Certainly it's my thinking. And that is, you know, that admire Nader enormously. I mean, Nader stands, you know, miles high above these other candidates in terms of his morality, in terms of his contribution to the country. But this election is the wrong place for him to put his great energy and talent. And it's a waste of his stature to put his all of his work that he has done into counting the votes in an election which he can't win anyway. And the Bush administration is so dangerous, and this is, I think, our feeling. This is the most dangerous administration we have had. It is so authoritarian, so fundamentalist. Juan mentioned the Patriot Act. It is unswerving in its determination, apparently, to rule the world and to go into war after war. And it is so dangerous an administration, so tied to the rich, although, sure, both parties are tied to the rich, one party tied a little more closely. But the Bush administration is so dangerous that I think it is very important to get these people out of office. And with Kerry in office, our thought is we will have a tiny ledge to stand on, from which then to move on.
I interviewed Ralph Nader, and he was, to say the least, very disturbed about this letter, and said at least the letter could have included a demand, that it wasn't just giving the support over unconditionally. And it's interesting, looking at your latest book that you did with Anthony Arnoff, Voices of a People's History of the United States, you begin with that famous quote of Frederick Douglass, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will.
Well, Frederick Douglass is right, and Ralph Nader is right, and probably the letter could have been stronger, I agree, in making demands. I think we need to make demands, even if we are saying vote for Kerry in swing states, we need to make demands of Kerry. And the important thing, and this I say on the basis of the history of presidential elections and the history of taking care of deep grievances in American society. The history shows that the really important thing is not who sits in the White House, but who sits outside the White House. The really important thing, you know, is not who is elected, even though it's sure it's a little better to have one candidate rather than another. The really important thing is what are citizens doing to create a huge movement in the country which will act upon, put pressure upon, make demands upon whatever candidate wins. That's the really important thing. So that, you know, I would support Kerry for 1 minute in the election booth before and after. I would try to join a movement of citizens that will demand that we get out of Iraq and demand that we use our immense resources to help people all over the world.
The debates did touch on the conditions of working Americans to some degree, although there was very little about the Bush administration's policy toward labor in this country, whether it's what it's done to OSHA, what it's done to the NLRB, what it's done to the right to unionize. Your assessment of how important the organized labor movement will be in this in the next few weeks, heading toward November 2nd?
Yeah, well, in general, Kerry has had the support of organized labor. I mean, unfortunately, organized labor is not in the kind of powerful position that organized labor was once in, but it's certainly clear, you know, that Kerry has a better position towards working people, towards labor unions and rights of labor unions, you know, than Bush has. And I think one of the key issues, whoever becomes president, is are we going to have a stronger labor movement? And are people going to organize wherever they are? We need more people in workplaces around the country that are not organized to organize and create a kind of collective strength so that they can then have an effect not only on their immediate situation in the workplace, but they can become a greater political force in the country.
Well, we're going to go to a clip of the candidates on labor. I want to thank you very much, Howard Zinn, for joining us. I'm very much looking forward to, on Friday, October 22nd, an event that you'll be participating in, Voices of a People's History of the United States reading. I remember fondly, what was it, a year ago, it must have been more, when the millionth copy of People's History was sold, and you had this event at the 92nd Street Y where Alice Walker and James Earl Jones and Danny Glover came out and did a reading from that. Now your new book, the same will happen. Howard Zinn, our guest. People's History of the United States is what he is so well known for. Now a new book, Voices of a People's History of the United States, written with Anthony Arnov. So we'll turn now to a clip of the candidates in Tempe, Arizona, talking about labor and then immigration. Our guest will be labor activist Brenda Stokely, who's one of those who's organizing the Million Worker March this weekend in Washington, D.C. Marina Hossa has a special this weekend called Immigrant Nation, and we'll talk about immigration.
You know, many experts say that a president really doesn't have much control over jobs. For example, if someone invents a machine that does the work of five people, that's progress. That's not the president's fault. So I ask you, is it fair to blame the administration entirely for this loss of jobs?
I don't blame them entirely for it. I blame the president for the things the president could do that has an impact on it. Outsourcing is going to happen. I've acknowledged that in union halls across the country. I've had shop stewards stand up and say, "Will you promise me you're going to stop all this outsourcing?" And I've looked them in the eye and I've said, "No, I can't do that." What I can promise you is that I will make the playing field as fair as possible. That I will, for instance, make certain that with respect to the tax system, that you as a worker in America are not subsidizing the loss of your job. Today, if you're an American business, you actually get a benefit for going overseas. You get to defer your taxes. So if you're looking at a competitive world, you say to yourself, hey, I do better overseas than I do here in America. That's not smart. I don't want American workers subsidizing the loss of their own job. And when I'm president, we're going to shut that loophole in a nanosecond, and we're going to use that money to lower corporate tax rates in America for all corporations, 5%. And we're going to have a manufacturing jobs credit and a job hiring credit so we actually help people be able to hire here. The second thing that we can do is provide a fair trade playing field. This president didn't stand up for Boeing when Airbus was violating international rules with subsidies. He discovered Boeing during the course of this campaign after I'd been talking about it for months. The fact is that the president had an opportunity to stand up and take on China for currency manipulation. There are companies that wanted to petition the administration. They were told, don't even bother. We're not going to listen to it. The fact is that there have been markets shut to us that we haven't stood up and fought for. I'm going to fight for a fair trade playing field for the American worker. And I will fight for the American worker just as hard as I fight for my own job. That's what the American worker wants. And if we do that, we can have an impact. Plus, we need fiscal discipline. Restore fiscal discipline, we'll do a lot better.
Mr. President.
Let me start with the Pell Grants. In his last litany of misstatements, he said, we cut Pell Grants. We've increased Pell Grants by 1 million students. That's a fact. You know, he talks to the workers. Let me talk to the workers. You got more money in your pocket as a result of the tax relief we passed and he opposed. If you have a child, you got a $1,000 child credit. That's money in your pocket. If you're married, we reduced the marriage penalty. The code ought to encourage marriage, not discourage marriage. We created a 10% bracket to help lower-income Americans. A family of four making $40,000 received about $1,700 in tax relief. It's your money. The way my opponent talks, he said, we're going to spend the government's money. No, we're spending your money. And when you have more money in your pocket, you're able to better afford things you want. I believe the role of government is to stand side by side with our citizens to help them realize their dreams, not tell citizens how to live their lives. My opponent talks about fiscal sanity. His record in the United States Senate does not match his rhetoric. He voted to increase taxes 98 times and to bust the budget 277 times.
Senator Kerry?
Bob, anybody can play with these votes. Everybody knows that. I have supported or voted for tax cuts over 600 times. I broke with my party in order to balance the budget. And Ronald Reagan signed into law the tax cut that we voted for. I voted for IRA tax cuts. I voted for small business tax cuts. But you know why the Pell Grants have gone up in their numbers? Because more people qualify for them because they don't have money. But they're not getting the $5,100 the president promised them. They're getting less money. There are more people who qualify. That's not what we want.
Senator, no one's playing when your votes. You voted to increase taxes 98 times. When they proposed reducing taxes, you voted against 126 times. You voted to violate the budget caps 277 times. You know, there's a mainstream in American politics, and you sit right on the far left bank. As a matter of fact, your record is such that Ted Kennedy, your colleague, is the conservative senator from Massachusetts.
George Bush, John Kerry, facing off last night in Tempe, Arizona, at Arizona State University. Another great rivalry was taking place yesterday, the Yankees versus the Red Sox, perhaps the more watched of those contests. When we come back, we'll be joined by labor activists Brenda Stokely and by CNN's Maria Hinojosa to talk about their views on immigration. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Pa' que su día no sea tan largo y con la luz de madrugada hace limpieza de sus encargos. Cierra los ojos pa' no mirarse, en el espejo se va notando su trabajo la estaca.
acabando. Es que su santo está en descanso. Todos los días, todas las horas, en esa espuma de sus tristezas, uñas y carne, sudor y fuerzas. Todo su empeño, todos sus sueños se van quedando en sus recuerdos, en la memoria de sus anhelos. Ay, melena negra, carita triste, rosa María, buscando vives tus días y noches una salida, que un domingo libra este infierno tuyo por tu alegría.
Lila Downs, La Niña, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Maria Hinojosa of CNN and Latino USA, and she'll be talking about immigration. But first, we wanted to turn to Brenda Stokely, who is one of the key organizers of this weekend's Million Worker March in Washington, D.C. Can you respond to the candidates on labor and talk about how you're organizing?
Well, this is definitely a rank-and-file grassroots organizing movement. It's I'm almost 60, and I haven't seen anything like this since the 60s in terms of the response. We're having difficulty even responding to people. We were organizing the buses. We all got commitments for those who could provide buses to provide seats, but now we have to come up with whole buses. And Danny Glover has been very instrumental in helping us do that, as well as other people, because we are responding to immigrant groups which have no money, and we're providing whole buses for them to get there. We're responding to shelters that have no money. These are displaced workers. Unfortunately, none of the internationals, with the exception of two international unions, have come forward to support. As a matter of fact, they've done everything to sort of undermine this particular effort. The only two now there's three, has been NEA and the postal workers, APWU, and now the Building Maintenance and Way, which are railroad workers that have recently endorsed. ILWU, Local 10 out of San Francisco, which we fondly refer to as the anti-apartheid local, because they're the ones who shut down the whole West Coast and refused to unload cargo from South Africa during the anti-apartheid movement. This call came from them. It came from their local. It came from their own international is not supporting it. And what they're trying to do is to gear everybody and lock everybody's hands to the Democratic Party and to Kerry, and not independently provide a space for workers to express their own concern and their own agenda. This is a beginning of a movement to mobilize people, as Howard Zinn was talking about, the kind of movement that's needed. Well, this movement is being built right before our eyes. And it poses a lot of questions, both within the anti-war movement and also within organized labor, as to why they would actively not in terms of unconsciously, but actively oppose such a movement of rank-and-file members, and why they're not. This movement includes people that are not in unions. As we all know, less than 12% of people are in unions. So we're appealing to people that are unorganized as well as people that are organized. And the response is unbelievable. People, their view is, why hasn't this happened before? One person even said to me, it was an old-time retired fireman in Harlem, we were postering, he said, you know, labor should have had something during the RNC. And I said, dear, labor did have something during the RNC on September the 1st. He said, I didn't know anything about it. And I said, because one, they excluded people that weren't in unions, they excluded retirees, and they excluded the key issues that were relating to workers. So we think our demands are very important for national health care for all, for workers' rights, because workers are being battered whether they're in unions or not. And they talk about the increase of numbers of people in new jobs. Those jobs are mainly temporary jobs, part-time jobs, per diem jobs, fee-for-service jobs, have no benefits, have no union representation. So these are not the kind of jobs. We're talking about jobs with a living wage, not a minimum wage. And we're talking about housing issues, all the issues that face working communities every single day.
Labor and immigration are intimately intertwined. Let's hear the presidential candidates talk about immigration last night in Tempe, Arizona.
I'm told that at least 8,000 people cross our borders illegally every day. Some people believe this is a security issue, as you know. Some believe it's an economic issue. Some see it as a human rights issue. How do you see it, and what do we need to do about it?
I see it as a serious problem. I see it as a security issue. I see it as an economic issue, and I see it as a human rights issue. We're increasing the border security of the United States. We've got 1,000 more Border Patrol agents on the southern border. We're using new equipment. We're using unmanned vehicles to spot people coming across. And we'll continue to do so over the next 4 years. It's a subject I'm very familiar with. After all, I was a border governor for a while. Many people are coming to this country for economic reasons. They're coming here to work. If you can make 50 cents in the heart of Mexico, for example, or make $5 here in America, $5.15, you're going to come here if you're worth your salt, if you want to put food on the table for your families. And that's what's happening. And so in order to take pressure off the border, in order to make the borders more secure, I believe there ought to be a temporary worker card that allows a willing worker and a willing employer to mate up, so long as there's not an American willing to do the job, to join up in order to be able to fulfill the employer's needs. That has the benefit of making sure our employers aren't breaking the law as they try to fill their workforce needs. It makes sure that the people coming across the border are humanely treated, that they're not kept in the shadows of our society, that they're able to go back and forth to see their families. See, the card will have a period of time attached to it. It also means it takes pressure off the border. If somebody is coming here to work with a card, it means they're not going to have to sneak across the border. It means our Border Patrol will be more likely to be able to focus on doing their job. Now, it's very important for our citizens to also know that I don't believe we ought to have amnesty. I don't think we ought to reward illegal behavior. There are plenty of people standing in line to become a citizen, and we ought not to crowd these people ahead of them in line. If they want to become a citizen, they can stand in line too. And here's where my opponent and I differ. In September 2003, he supported amnesty for illegal aliens.
That is President Bush. We'll hear John Kerry's response on immigration. But before we do that, Maria Hinojosa, you have a major special coming up on CNN Sunday night called Immigrant Nation. Can you respond to what President Bush just said?
You know, it was interesting, Amy, because I was watching the debates, and I was not clear whether or not they were going to talk about immigration, because it's the one invisible issue that hasn't been brought up. And I said, they've got to bring it up in Arizona. They've just got to. But the time was going on, and I was putting my kids to sleep and running back. And when they actually ended up talking about it, I had to run and get like an envelope because I was so surprised that they were actually addressing the issue. I think what we did in this CNN documentary that's going to run on Sunday night called Immigrant Nation, Divided Country, is we went into the front lines because there's so much doublespeak on the part of the politicians. I mean, right there, even with George Bush talking, he's saying on the one hand that there's more border security, but all of the numbers show that there's actually more people getting into this country than ever before without proper documentation. On the one hand, he's saying we want to give workers a chance to be legal while they're working here, but we're not going to give them amnesty. So it's this continual doublespeak. And one of the things that I saw on the ground, because we focused on immigration into the American South, what I think is now the new front lines of immigration, is that people are so frustrated on the ground that there's a real bubbling up of activism against these immigrants. Post 9/11, it's almost like you can dislike immigrants and it's okay, no matter who you are, no matter what side you're on. Liberals dislike immigrants, conservatives dislike immigrants, and you've got a real bubbling up on the ground of anti-illegal immigrant, what they say, I'm an anti-illegal alien activist.
Let's hear John Kerry on the issue.
With respect to immigration reform, the president broke his promise on immigration reform. He said he would reform it. 4 years later, he's now promising another plan. Here's what I'll do. Number one, the borders are more leaking today than they were before 9/11. The fact is, we haven't done what we need to do to toughen up our borders, and I will. Secondly, we need a guest worker program, but if it's all we have, it's not going to solve the problem.
The second thing we need is to crack down on illegal hiring. It's against the law in the United States to hire people illegally. And we ought to be enforcing that law properly. And thirdly, we need an earned legalization program for people who've been here for a long time, stayed out of trouble, got a job, paid their taxes, and their kids are American. We've got to start moving them towards full citizenship out of the shadows.
You want to respond?
That was John Kerry, Maria Hinojosa.
You know, it's interesting because my first take when I was hearing this was I actually started to think that Kerry sounded a little bit more conservative in tone than George Bush did, which was a little bit strange. You know, maybe some people might not expect that from the Democrats. I think the big difference here is in terms of people who are concerned about immigrants' rights is the fact that Kerry is talking about full legalization or the possibility of full legalization citizenship. Again, on the ground where I was doing this documentary in Atlanta, outside of Atlanta, I spoke to a Southern employer who owns a 150-year-old chalet. I really didn't know what to expect from him. Big Southern guy, you know, just that kind of typical image. And I was concerned when I was interviewing him about the employees that he had. And his response to me, first thing he said was, if all of these immigrants are here and they've been here a year and they haven't broken the law while they're here and they want to become citizens, they should become citizens immediately. Not something I expected to hear on the ground from an employer in Georgia. But that's some of the perspectives that we got in this documentary.
And interestingly, I think you're right that Kerry at first sounded as he was actually more for the militarization of the border than even Bush was. And but what I'm amazed at is that neither one dealt with what is causing this massive immigration. What are the conditions in the countries that Bush referred to it a little bit? A lot of it caused by the United States in terms of what is bringing so many people to this country, and also a few of them dealt with the fact that the nation, with an increasingly aging population, is going to need more immigrants, not less, in the decades to come.
You know, Juan, it's interesting because I'm Mexican. Although when I was asked by one of our characters in the documentary, who's very much against what he calls illegal aliens, the first thing he said was he asked me, are you a citizen? Almost as if he wouldn't talk to me unless I was. But I go back to Mexico a lot, oftentimes mostly to be with family, not often as a reporter, but being in this small town in Veracruz and witnessing firsthand the fact that the entire town is decimated. All of the men are gone, and this is because of the fact that the economic area of Veracruz has just been decimated because of the closing of petroleum refineries, etc. I mean, you're exactly right. The issue is, in the long run, unless there's some kind of binational dealing with the development issues in Mexico, and as long as you have these people who, if they're able to survive getting through the desert and all of the other challenges, will be rewarded by a job with either a low wage or a higher wage, depending on where they are, you're going to have people who make that decision, just like the woman in the documentary who is now, even now, trying to get her children across the border, probably even before Sunday night when our documentary airs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Maria Hinojosa, the documentary Immigrant Nation, spending an hour on this issue on CNN. Very interesting.
And I'd also like to ask for Brenda, people who want to attend the Million Worker March, how can they contact the organizers and get more information?
Well, in New York City, they can call 212-219-0022, extension 5185. We have buses in every borough, and so we welcome people to come and get a seat and go down with us.
People around the country are coming?
Yes, around the country. And also we're going to have the important aspect of the march is that they're going to be organizing tents so that people will not just be rallying, but they will also leave with an agenda and a plan and connect to national activities and campaigns. So we invite everybody to come and participate.
Well, Brenda Stokely, want to thank you very much. We'll have links on our website at democracynow.org. Brenda Stokely is president of AFSCME, District Council 1707 in New York City, one of the key organizers of the Million Worker March this weekend in Washington, D.C. And that does it for the program. A lot of announcements of programs that are happening this weekend. Democracy Now! Producers involved, Jeremy Scahill will be emceeing the Speak Up event Saturday in New York at the Jacob Javits Center, the CMJ Music Festival with Moby, Dead Prez, Guerrilla News Network, and other musicians. Sunday, he'll be at the premiere of Greg Palast documentary, Bush Family Fortunes, gregpalast.com for info. We're headed up tonight to Toronto. We'll be speaking tonight, and tomorrow we'll be broadcasting for the first time ever a bi-national broadcast of The Current, the CBC National Morning Show, simulcasting with Democracy Now! Going to Canada, we'll also address the issue of health care. On Friday night, be in Berkeley at the Congregational Church. On Saturday, we'll be in Marin at the Bioneers Conference. Sunday in Rochester. And that event will be changed to 6 o'clock in the afternoon and in the morning in Ithaca. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdo Kadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton. Our engineers are Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy. Our website for all contact information is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.